Adams later cited the diabolical intrigues of Hamilton and his colleagues, contending that he had pursued negotiations with France at the expense of all my consequence in the world and their unanimous and immortal hatred. Adams's success came too late to sway the presidential election, and therefore bore a bittersweet flavor. The bad timing only exacerbated his sense of being unlucky, unloved, and unappreciated. His admirers have echoed his view that he had acted in a noble, self-sacrificing manner, but his motives were not entirely saintly. He had adopted a hawkish stance toward France when that was popular early in his administration, and then taken a more conciliatory posture to curry favor with Republicans as the 1800 election beckoned. By that point, his moderation was popular with electors in some critical states. George Clinton said that Adams, having sent a special mission to France and effected a peace, came very near preventing the election of Mr. Jefferson to the presidency. If the Republicans had not already named Jefferson for president, we should have supported Mr. Adams. The peace mission to France was unquestionably the supreme triumph of the Adams presidency, but it testifies to political agility as well as wisdom. By mid-December 1800, it was evident that Jefferson and Burr would garner an equal number of electoral votes, throwing the presidential contest into a lame duck House of Representatives that was still dominated by Federalists. While no constitutional mechanism differentiated between the votes for president and vice president, it had been understood among Republicans that Jefferson was the presidential candidate. Afraid of jeopardizing Burr's chances for the vice presidency, Jefferson had held back from asking Republican electors to drop a few votes for Burr to ensure that he himself would come out on top. At first, Burr reacted to the tie vote in a gracious, honorable way, just as Jefferson had expected. He wrote to Republican Samuel Smith and renounced the sacrilegious thought of challenging Jefferson for the presidency. "It is highly improbable that I shall have an equal number of votes with Mr. Jefferson, but if such should be the result, every man who knows me ought to know that I should utterly disclaim all competition." At least one knowledgeable observer doubted that Burr's intentions were quite so benign. Hamilton was privy to rumors that Federalists in Congress might prefer Burr to Jefferson. So when he learned of the projected tie vote, he fired off a letter to Oliver Wolcott Jr. to nip trouble in the bud. "As to Burr, there is nothing in his favor. His private character is not defended by his most partial friends. He is bankrupt beyond redemption, except by the plunder of his country. His public principles have no other spring or aim than his own aggrandizement. If he can, he will certainly disturb our institutions to secure to himself permanent power, and with it, wealth. He is truly the Catiline of America." This was a powerful indictment. In ancient Rome, Catiline was notorious for his personal dissipation and treacherous schemes to undermine the Republic. In order to stop Burr, Hamilton decided to back his perpetual rival, Thomas Jefferson, telling Wolcott that Jefferson is by far not so dangerous a man, and he has pretensions to character. He also thought that Jefferson was much more talented than the overrated Burr, and that the latter was far more cunning than wise, far more dexterous than able. "In my opinion, he is inferior in real ability to Jefferson." Hamilton's endorsement of Jefferson was the most improbable reversal in an improbable career. Nobody enjoyed Hamilton's embarrassing predicament in having to choose between his two enemies more than John Adams. The very man, the very two men, of all the world that he was most jealous of, are now placed above him, Adams said with pardonable gloating. Even in the thick of the campaign that summer, Hamilton had noted Burr's electoral intrigues in New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Vermont, and surmised that he was only feigning deference to Jefferson. Burr alone had engaged in open electioneering, while Jefferson, Adams, and Pinckney stuck to the gentlemanly protocol of avoiding the stump. The alliance between Burr and Jefferson had been a marriage of convenience to pull New York into the Republican camp. "I never indeed thought him an honest, frank-dealing man," Jefferson later said of Burr, "but considered him as a crooked gun or other perverted machine, whose aim or shot you could never be sure of." That Jefferson twice recruited this crooked gun for his running mate indicates just how cynical he could be. Burr, in turn, still believed that he had been betrayed by Jefferson in the 1796 election, when he got only one vote in Virginia. "As to my Jeff," he wrote with mordant whimsy, "after what happened at the last election, et tu, Brute, I was really averse to having my name in question, but being so, it is most obvious that I should not choose to be trifled with." Despite Burr's declaration that he would yield the presidency to Jefferson, Federalist leaders pelted Hamilton with letters about the expediency of supporting Burr and ending Virginia's political hegemony. Because Burr lusted after money and power, they thought they could strike a bargain with him. They worried less about Burr's loose morals than about what they perceived as Jefferson's atheism. Clergymen were telling their congregations that if Jefferson became president, they would need to hide their Bibles and his doctrinaire views. Better an opportunist than a dangerous ideologue, many Federalists thought. Fisher Ames feared that Jefferson was absurd enough to believe his own nonsense, while Burr might at least impart vigor to the country. John Marshall and others thought Burr a safer choice than Jefferson, who might try to recast the Constitution to conform to his Jacobin tenets. If forced to choose, Hamilton preferred a man with wrong principles to one devoid of any. "There is no circumstance which has occurred in the course of our political affairs that has given me so much pain as the idea that Mr. Burr might be elevated to the presidency by the means of the Federalists," Hamilton told Wolcott. If the party elected Burr, it would be exposed to the disgrace of a defeat in an attempt to elevate to the first place in the government one of the worst men in the community. Hamilton had never spoken about Adams and Jefferson in these terms. "The appointment of Burr as president would disgrace our country abroad," he informed Sedgwick. "No agreement with him could be relied upon." Unlike other Federalists, Hamilton did not think Burr would be a harmless, lackadaisical president. "He is sanguine enough to hope everything, daring enough to attempt everything, wicked enough to scruple nothing," Hamilton told Governor Morris. From his legal practice, Hamilton knew that Burr had exorbitant debts and might be susceptible to bribes from foreign governments. He briefed Federalists about the scandals involving Burr and the Holland Company and the gross trickery behind the Manhattan Company. While Inspector General, Hamilton had had a disturbing conversation with Burr that he now repeated to Robert Troop and two other friends. "General, you are now at the head of the army," Burr had told him. "You are a man of the first talents and of vast influence. Our Constitution is a miserable paper machine. You have it in your power to demolish it and give us a proper one, and you owe it to your friends and the country to do it." To which Hamilton said, he replied, "Why, Colonel Burr, in the first place, the little army I command is totally inadequate to the object you mention. And in the second place, if the army were adequate, I am too much troubled with that thing called morality to make the attempt." Reverting to French, Burr pooh-poohed this timidity. "General, all things are moral to great souls." So unalterably opposed was Hamilton to Burr that he told Federalist friends that he would withdraw from the party or even from public life if they installed Burr as president. By endorsing Burr, he warned, the Federalists would be signing their own death warrant. Hamilton feared that Burr might supplant him as de facto party head, or might even foster a third party composed of disenchanted elements from the other two. Either way, Hamilton feared he would be shunted aside. Had he risked his career to block Adams's re-election only to have Aaron Burr fill the void? By late December 1800, as Hamilton had forewarned, Burr changed his mind. He would not seek the presidency, but neither would he reject it if the House chose him over Jefferson. Burr told Samuel Smith that he was offended by the presumption that he should resign if elected president. It bothered him that Republicans, who had embraced him for expediency as vice president, now blanched at him becoming president. By adopting this defiant stand, Burr pushed the situation to the brink of crisis. In early January, Hamilton heard of a Burr bandwagon gaining force among Federalists. By late January, his sources were saying that the Federalists were decidedly, even unanimously, in favor of Burr over Jefferson. Faced with this terrifying vision of a Burr presidency, Hamilton was forced to come up with his most candid, fair-minded and perceptive appraisal of Jefferson. During the 1800 campaign, Federalists had vilified Jefferson as a coward, a spendthrift, and a voluptuary, not to mention a potential demagogue wedded to noxious dogmas. Federalist Robert G. Harper mocked Jefferson as fit to be a professor in a college or president of a philosophical society, but certainly not the first magistrate of a great nation. Now, Hamilton had to combat rooted notions that he himself had helped to propagate. In one letter, Hamilton confessed to having said many unflattering things about Jefferson. "I admit that his politics are tinctured with fanaticism, that he is crafty and persevering in his objects, that he is not scrupulous about the means of success, nor very mindful of truth, and that he is a contemptible hypocrite." At the same time, he admitted that Jefferson was often more fervent in rhetoric than in action, and would be a more cautious president than his principles might suggest. He predicted accurately that Jefferson's penchant for France, once it was no longer politically useful, would be discarded. In an abrupt volte-face on January 29, 1800, Jefferson, after learning that Napoleon had made himself dictator, wrote, "It is very material for the American people to be made sensible that their own character and situation are materially different from the French." Hamilton had been saying this for a decade. Hamilton was also dubious about Jefferson's past preference for congressional power. He shrewdly noted that whenever it suited his views, Jefferson had supported executive power, as if he knew he would someday inherit the presidency and did not wish to weaken the office. Hamilton told James A. Bayard of Delaware, "I have more than once made the reflection that viewing himself as the reversioner, that is, one having a vested right to a future inheritance, he was solicitous to come into possession of a good estate." The fierce debates about Jefferson and Burr took place amid a welter of reports that the Federalists would refuse to yield power. One Republican scenario hypothesized that desperate Federalists would prevent both Republican candidates from being elected, and that President Adams would choose a Federalist successor to head an interim government. One of Hamilton's adversaries from the Whiskey Rebellion, Hugh Henry Brackenridge, envisioned Hamilton descending upon the Capitol with an army that would seize control of the government during the deadlock. Governor Thomas McKean of Pennsylvania swore that if Republicans were denied their victory, the Pennsylvania militia, 20,000 strong, would march upon the Capitol and arrest any congressman who named someone other than Jefferson or Burr as president. Burr concurred that any Federalist attempt to subvert the election should be met by a resort to the sword. Nobody was more upset by talk of extra-legal schemes than Hamilton, who thought that any interference with the election would be most dangerous and unbecoming. The Federalists nourished their own fantasies of Republican plots, and Hamilton himself later claimed that Republican groups had colluded to cut off the leading Federalists and seize the government if Jefferson did not make it to the presidency. One Federalist newspaper quoted Jefferson's partisans as issuing shrill threats that if Burr became president, we will march and dethrone him as an usurper. If Federalists dared to place in the presidential chair any other than the philosopher of Monticello, 10,000 Republican swords will instantly leap from their scabbards in defense of the violated rights of the people. This hysterical atmosphere only intensified as congressmen tried to resolve the stalemate between Jefferson and Burr. It was not until February 11, 1801, that votes cast by presidential electors in the various states were actually opened in the Senate chamber, confirming what was already common knowledge, that Jefferson and Burr had tied with 73 votes apiece. It was a snowy day in the brand new Capitol. The helter-skelter site was a swampy, ramshackle village with a few boarding houses clustered around an unfinished Capitol. Henry Adams quipped that it had two wings without a body, as well as some houses and stores near an unfinished executive mansion. The north wing of the Capitol still lacked a roof, and Pennsylvania Avenue was studded with tree stumps. Quail and wild turkey abounded, and the sharp reports of hunters' guns punctuated construction sounds. It was very much a southern town, with 10,000 white citizens, 700 free blacks, and 3,000 slaves. As a result, the majority of the 600 workers who erected the White House and the Capitol were slaves, whose wages were garnished by their masters. The federal government was still so small that when it had moved from Philadelphia the previous year, the complete executive branch archives fit neatly into 8 packing cases. Once the ballots were counted, the high drama moved to the House of Representatives. Each of the 16 states was allowed a single vote for president, reflecting the majority sentiment of its delegation, and the winner would need a simple majority of 9 votes. Since Federalists had dominated the outgoing Congress, their preference for Burr might have seemed conclusive. But matters were more complicated since the Federalist votes were so concentrated in New England. On the first ballot, 6 states voted for Burr versus 8 for Jefferson, who fell 1 vote short of winning. The delegations of the 2 remaining states, Vermont and Maryland, were evenly divided and therefore cast no votes. Since neither Jefferson nor Burr had 9 votes, an impasse ensued that opened the door to further mischief, and rumors flew about that the Virginia militia was preparing to march on Washington. After Hamilton's infamous Adams pamphlet, his power over the Federalists had dwindled. His judgment was now suspect, his actions imputed to personal pique. The first ballot deadlock confirmed his sense of his own waning power. Robert Troup reported, "Hamilton is profoundly chagrined with this prospect. He has taken infinite pains to defeat Burr's election, but he believes in vain." Hamilton declared that his influence with the federal party was wholly gone, that he could no longer be useful. Nonetheless, Hamilton was not one to give up easily. He had already told Governor Morris that he could support Jefferson with a clear conscience if the latter provided assurances on certain points: the maintenance of the present system, especially on the cardinal articles of public credit, a navy, neutrality. Make any discreet use you think fit of this letter. Jefferson had seemed to resist any deal. In the early republic, secret agreements behind closed doors were regarded as distasteful relics of monarchical ways. Nevertheless, the outlines of Hamilton's deal were to linger and ultimately prevail. It was a long, hard road to the final ballot at the Capitol. The first session, which droned on for 20 hours, did not adjourn until 9 o'clock the next morning. Refreshments were brought to parched members at their seats. Some dozed in overcoats or lay down on the floor. One sick legislator, who had not been present at first, was carried through the snow and set down on a cot in an adjoining room, ready to vote if necessary. For 5 grueling days, the legislators suffered through 35 ballots that continued to replicate the original 8-6 vote for Jefferson. The tedious pace only fostered concerns that disappointed Federalists would stall the vote until after the March 4th inauguration date and then anoint their own candidate as president. Afterward, both Jefferson and Burr swore that they had chastely refrained from politicking during the 35 ballots. Recent scholarship has tended to exonerate Burr from charges that he did anything untoward, and he certainly did not bargain outright. In the weeks before the balloting, his romantic liaisons seemed to bulk far larger in his correspondence than the presidential contest. His wife, Theodosia, had died of stomach cancer in 1794. Besides his amorous intrigues, Burr was busy with parochial New York politics and preparing for the wedding of his only child, his beloved daughter, Theodosia. Nonetheless, Burr's behavior was not as passive as it seemed, for his silence and inaction stated eloquently that he was willing to defy the intentions of Republican electors and accept the presidency. Joanne Freeman has written that Burr made one fundamental mistake. He did nothing to hide his interest in the office. Hamilton had little doubt that Burr was maneuvering for the presidency. "Hamilton has often said he could prove it to the satisfaction of any court and jury," Robert Troup told Rufus King. The situation was tailor-made for Jefferson, who specialized in subtle, roundabout action. He denied stoutly that he had compromised to break the deadlock and told James Monroe, "I have declared to the Federalists unequivocally that I would not receive the government on capitulation, that I would not go into it with my hands tied." That Jefferson believed his own version is certain. He did not lie to others so much as to himself. John Quincy Adams later observed of Jefferson that he had a memory so pandering to the will that in deceiving others he seems to have begun by deceiving himself. He now stuck by the serviceable fiction that he had refused to negotiate with the Federalists. The man who helped to rescue the representatives from their misery was James A. Bayard, a Delaware Federalist. A thick-set lawyer known for sartorial elegance, Bayard was under heavy Federalist pressure to vote for Burr, and did so for 35 ballots. As the lone representative of a tiny state, he was in a unique position. If he changed his vote, Delaware changed its vote. For 2 months, Hamilton bombarded him with letters spelling out Burr's flaws and heretical positions. I have heard him speak with applause of the French system as unshackling the mind and leaving it to its natural energies, and I have been present when he has contended against banking systems with earnestness. Burr lacked any fixed principles, Hamilton argued, and played instead on the floating passions of the multitude. Though Bayard did not like the deadlock vote, it was hard to resist the tide of Federalist support for Burr. When he suggested at one party caucus that he might vote for Jefferson to save the Constitution, he was hooted down with jeers of deserter. But after the caucus, Bayard huddled with two friends of Jefferson, John Nicholas of Virginia and Samuel Smith of Maryland. Quite possibly influenced by Hamilton's barrage of letters, Bayard set forth some Federalist prerequisites for supporting Jefferson. He would have to preserve Hamilton's financial system, maintain the Navy, and retain Federalist bureaucrats below cabinet level. After talking to Jefferson, Smith relayed to Bayard the candidate's opinion that the Federalists need not worry about the points mentioned. This smelled like a deal, and Bayard interpreted it as such. But Jefferson, ever the consummate politician, blandly called his chat with Smith a private tête-à-tête of no political consequence. Everybody involved kept up an air of perfect innocence. Timothy Pickering alleged that certain congressmen had sold their votes to Mr. Jefferson and received their pay in appointment to public offices. Had Burr been at the seat of government and made similar promises of appointments to offices, he would have been president instead of Jefferson. Perhaps softened up by Hamilton's diatribes, Bayard later claimed he had doubted Burr's Federalist credentials all along. On the 36th round of voting in the House, he submitted a blank ballot and withdrew Delaware's vote from the Burr column. Simultaneously, Federalist abstentions in Vermont and Maryland gave Jefferson 10 votes and a clear-cut victory. Burr, cut loose by both parties, was left in a political limbo for the rest of his life. While his second-place finish earned him the vice presidency, it simultaneously earned him the enmity of President-elect Jefferson. Jefferson probably owed his victory to Hamilton as much as to any other politician. Hamilton's pamphlet had first dealt a blow to Adams, though not a mortal one, and he had then intervened to squelch Burr's chances for the presidency, paving the way for a Federalist deal with Jefferson. As the first incumbent president in American history defeated for re-election, John Adams had a chance to set a precedent and end his tenure with dignity. But during his final days in office, he brooded alone and grieved over the recent death of his alcoholic son, Charles, whom he had refused to see again. On March 4th, 1801, the day of Jefferson's inauguration, Adams, now a balding, toothless, cantankerous old man, climbed into a stagecoach at 4 o'clock in the morning and left for Massachusetts 8 hours before Thomas Jefferson was sworn into office. No other president in American history was to choose to boycott his successor's inauguration. "The golden age is past," mourned Abigail Adams. "God grant that it may not be succeeded by an age of terror." At 10 o'clock that morning, Aaron Burr was sworn in as vice president in the Senate chamber and then retreated to the seat from which he would oversee the Senate for the next 4 years. Jefferson showed up around noon, accompanied by Adams's cabinet. To radiate Republican simplicity, the new president wore plain clothes and marched behind a modest militia detachment. Secure in his victory, Jefferson believed that he embodied the will of the American people and could afford to be magnanimous in his inaugural address. He struck a conciliatory note when he remarked in a soft, almost inaudible voice, "We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." As Joseph Ellis has noted, in his handwritten draft of the speech, Jefferson did not capitalize Republicans and Federalists, making the famous statement a little less generous than it seemed. Jefferson sounded quite a different note when he said in a private letter that he would sink federalism into an abyss from which there shall be no resurrection. In New York, Hamilton monitored the inaugural speech for compliance with a tacit deal that Jefferson had made with the Federalists. He was pleased to see that Jefferson promised to honor the funding system, the national debt, and the Jay Treaty. Hamilton wrote, "We view it as virtually a candid retraction of past misapprehensions and a pledge to the community that the new president will not lend himself to dangerous innovations, but in essential points will tread in the steps of his predecessors." This grandly bipartisan tone wouldn't last for long. Hamilton had intuited rightly that Jefferson, once in office, would be reluctant to reject executive powers he had deplored in opposition. Madison was appointed Secretary of State and Albert Gallatin Secretary of the Treasury. Gallatin had been a persistent critic of Hamilton, publishing a pamphlet during the campaign claiming that Hamilton had enlarged the public debt instead of shrinking it. But as Treasury Secretary, he discovered merits in Hamilton's National Bank, which he had lambasted as a congressman. Hamilton, meanwhile, began his long retreat to the status of a prophet without honor. Chapter 38, A World Full of Folly. Once Jefferson became president, Hamilton, 46, began to fade from public view, an abrupt fall for a man whose rise had been so spectacular, so incandescent. If stripped of his former political standing, however, he remained at the pinnacle of the legal profession, exerting influence over a wide range of New York institutions. He drew up a will for a wealthy retired seaman, Robert Richard Randall, who wanted to set up a sanctuary for retired American merchant sailors. The resulting home on Staten Island was called Sailor's Snug Harbor. Hamilton also tendered legal advice to the Church of St. Mark's in the Bowery as it sought independent status within the Trinity Church Parish. But no legal fame or fortune could offset the painful decline of his political stature. From the time of his first newspaper essays at King's College, Hamilton had shown a steady knack for being near the center of power. He had gravitated to Washington's wartime staff, the Confederation Congress, the Constitutional Convention, and the first government. Now he was exiled from the main political action, a great general with no army marching behind him. In his more despairing moments, Hamilton had long toyed with the fantasy of retiring to a tranquil rural life, especially as Philip Schuyler continued to badger him about his cerebral, sedentary labors. But something had held him back. Part of the problem was that Hamilton was a quintessentially urban man who preferred to commune with books, not running brooks. The other founders, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Adams, had plantations or substantial farms from which they had drawn financial and spiritual sustenance, while Hamilton had remained a city dweller, harnessed to his work. This began to change in the late 1790s as Hamilton found increasing solace in his family. Away on a business trip, he chided Eliza mildly for not having written about their sick infant Eliza. "It is absolutely necessary to me, when absent, to hear frequently of you and my dear children. While all other passions decline in me, those of love and friendship gain new strength. It will be more and more my endeavor to abstract myself from all pursuits which interfere with those of affection. 'Tis here only I can find true pleasure." To fulfill his pledge of spending more time with his family, Hamilton formed a sweet project to build a country house 9 miles north of Lower Manhattan. He told a friend laughingly, "A disappointed politician is very apt to take refuge in a garden." During the fall of 1799, he and Eliza rented a country house along with the churches in the vicinity of Harlem Heights. This decision probably owed something to the yellow fever epidemics that visited the city each autumn. Hamilton knew the area well. On fishing expeditions up the Hudson, he sometimes moored his boat to a dock owned by pharmacist Jacob Shefflin, who had a lovely summer house on a nearby hilltop. Hamilton was so enraptured by the exquisite vista from this house that he tried to buy it. Instead, in August 1800, Shefflin sold him an adjoining 15-acre parcel with a 200-foot elevation, with views of the Hudson River on one side and the Harlem River and East River on the other. From physician Samuel Bradhurst, Hamilton bought an additional 20 acres. The combined property was picturesquely wooded and watered by two streams that converged in a duck pond. It had outlying buildings, including stables, barns, sheds, gardens, orchards, fences, and a chicken house. The property was bisected by Bloomingdale Road, today Hamilton Place, which provided a fast, direct connection by stagecoach or carriage to Manhattan or Albany. Hamilton called his retreat the Grange, a name that paid homage both to the ancestral Hamilton manse in Scotland and the plantation of Uncle James Lytton in St. Croix. It was to be the only surviving residence linked to Hamilton's memory, and the only one we know for certain that he owned. Its name suggested both pride in his Scottish ancestry and a more relaxed attitude toward his Caribbean origins. One day, Hamilton was riding up to Albany to visit Eliza's ailing sister Peggy and had to choose between bringing her a pie or a basket of crabs. Upon reflection, he told Eliza, he had opted for crabs. Perhaps as a Creole, I had some sympathy with them. 20 years before, Hamilton would never have hazarded such a flippant remark about his boyhood. The Hamiltons used the existing farmhouse as a temporary residence until they completed a new structure. For this home, Hamilton drafted a man whom he had once hired at Treasury to design lighthouses, John McComb, Jr., then the most prominent New York architect, who had just finished Gracie Mansion and was working on a new city hall. The main contractor was Ezra Weeks, brother of Levi, whom Hamilton had defended in the Manhattan Well tragedy case. From his sawmills at Saratoga, Philip Schuyler shipped planks and boards down the Hudson, along with hand-carved timber, still rough with bark, to decorate the children's attic. He also sent enormous bushels of potatoes and wheels of cheese. Hamilton brimmed with so much nervous energy that he could not remain aloof from any project for long and collaborated with McComb on everything from the design of the tall chimneys to the Italian marble fireplaces. Like all new homeowners, he had scouted other residences for ideas. On one journey to Connecticut, he told Eliza, I remark as I go along everything that can be adopted for the embellishment of our little retreat, where I hope for a pure and unalloyed happiness with my excellent wife and sweet children. The two-story federal house that McComb and Weeks completed by the summer of 1802 occupied a spot near the corner of present-day West 143rd Street and Convent Avenue. It was later moved south for preservation purposes. The neat, handsome structure had a yellow and ivory frame exterior, topped by classical balusters. With 6 rooms upstairs and 8 fireplaces to warm the family in winter, it was clearly designed with Hamilton's brood of 7 children in mind. As elegantly meticulous as Hamilton himself, the house was small for a man of his fame, though marked with mementos of his past power. Visitors entering the doorway under a delicate fanlight glimpsed a Gilbert Stuart painting of George Washington, a gift from Washington himself. Ironically, the Anglophile Hamilton furnished the parlor with a Louis XVI sofa and chairs. The centerpiece of the house was 2 octagonal rooms that stood side by side, one serving as parlor, the other as dining room. When the doors were thrown open, they created a single, continuous space in which to entertain guests. The mirrored doors that covered 3 sides of the parlor reflected the leafy landscape seen through the high French windows. Further blending the living room with the sylvan setting, the windows opened onto a balcony with panoramic river views. Incapable of total relaxation, Hamilton had probably never experienced an indolent day in his life, he commandeered for his study a tiny room to the right of the entryway and fitted it out with a beautiful roll-top desk that he called My Secretary at Home. This compulsive bibliophile packed the Grange with up to 1,000 volumes. Perhaps the aspect of this hideaway that most captivated Hamilton was landscaping it and growing fruit and vegetable gardens. As a newcomer to the bucolic life, he humbly sought assistance from friends and country neighbors. In this new situation, for which I am as little fitted as Jefferson is to guide the helm of the United States, I come to you as an adept in rural science for instruction, he wrote to Richard Peters, an agricultural expert. He also drew on the expertise of his friend and physician David Hossack, who also served as a renowned botany professor at Columbia College. Hossack had just established a botanical garden with greenhouses and tropical plants where Rockefeller Center stands today. En route to or from the Grange, Hamilton surveyed Hossack's flowers and frequently rode off with cuttings, bulbs, and seeds. He even communicated a political message through his gardening. Among the many shade trees that he dispersed around the grounds, he planted to the right of the front door a row of 13 sweet gum trees meant to symbolize the union of the original 13 states. We know about Hamilton's supervision of the grounds because he was often away on business and left detailed instructions for Eliza, who oversaw much of the day-to-day development. Hamilton was enchanted by an ornamental bed of tulips, lilies, and hyacinths that Hossack had devised, and he sent a drawing of it to Eliza. With his usual exactitude, he told her, "The space should be a circle of which the diameter is 18 feet, and there should be 9 of each sort of flowers. They may be arranged thus. Wild roses around the outside of the flower garden, with laurel at foot. A few dogwood trees, not large, scattered along the margin of the grove, would be very pleasant." Hamilton also planted strawberries, cabbages, and asparagus, and constructed an ice house covered with cedar shingles. Eliza kept close tabs on outlays for the Grange, which proved an extravagance for a couple with 7 children. Always a tightwad compared to Jefferson, Hamilton began to spend with an open hand and lavished about $25,000, or twice his annual income, on the house and grounds. Since the property itself cost $55,000, the cumulative expense dragged Hamilton into debt. He was aware that his liberal spending was outstripping his wealth, but anticipated that his growing legal practice would defray future bills. In the past, Hamilton had been somewhat cavalier about collecting legal fees, but he now demanded payment from clients in arrears. When he asked one client to pay for a will drawn up many years earlier, he explained, "As I am building, I am endeavoring to collect my outstanding claims." For Alexander and Eliza Hamilton, the country house ushered in a new stage of their lives with a mellow autumnal tone. The Grange did double duty as both rustic refuge and posh venue for dinner parties. The Hamiltons functioned as a complete, stable family as they seldom had before. Both Alexander and Eliza had been upset that his career had so often separated them and caused the children to be split up between them. Her life's greatest sacrifice, Eliza once said, was that of being one half the week absent from him, Hamilton, to take care of the younger while he took care of the elder children. For someone with Hamilton's early family history, these separations must have carried an extra burden of anxiety and frustration. Hamilton made more and more time for his children. On one occasion, when Eliza went to Albany, he wrote to her from the Grange, "I am here, my beloved Betsy, with my 2 little boys, John and William, who will be my bedfellows tonight. The remainder of the children were well yesterday." Eliza pouts and plays and displays more and more her ample stock of caprice. He liked to sing with the family and gather them in the gardens on Sunday mornings to read the Bible aloud. Hamilton's children tended to remember their father at the Grange, partly because they were older then and partly because it was there that they had the full attention of a man whose life had been hectic and distracted by controversy. The new squire was no passive spectator of the national scene and followed avidly the fortunes of Aaron Burr. Once Jefferson entered the White House, Burr was no longer just expendable to the president. He was an outright hindrance. After betraying Jefferson's trust during the electoral tie, Burr knew he would probably be dropped as vice president when Jefferson sought re-election, and in the meantime he was pointedly excluded from the president's councils. We are told, and we believe, that Jefferson and Burr hate each other, and Hamilton thinks that Jefferson is too cunning to be outwitted by him, Robert Troup reported to Rufus King. As Burr became a pariah in Washington, he realized that he had to shore up his political base at home. By coincidence, an acrimonious race for New York governor followed the electoral stalemate in Washington. That old Republican warhorse George Clinton decided to seek yet another term as governor. When John Jay declined to run for re-election, the Federalists turned to 36-year-old Stephen Van Rensselaer, the incumbent lieutenant governor and Hamilton's brother-in-law. That Hamilton would get involved was further assured when Burr began to meddle on behalf of Clinton. For Hamilton, this exposed the shameless deceit behind Burr's flirtation with the Federalists during the tie election. He said in sarcastic tones to Eliza, Mr. Burr, as a proof of his conversion to federalism, has within a fortnight taken a very active and officious part against Van Rensselaer in favor of Clinton. Hamilton had a compelling personal motive for entering the fray. Eliza's younger sister Peggy was married to Stephen Van Rensselaer. Hamilton crowned her with the comic nickname Mrs. Patroon, and had been gravely ill for 2 years. For a time, doctors plied her with oxygen that helped to revive her. Then, in early March 1801, while Hamilton was waylaid in Albany on legal business, Peggy's health deteriorated. Hamilton visited her bedside often and kept Eliza posted on developments. When Hamilton finished his court work, Peggy asked him to stay for a few days, and he complied with her wishes. In mid-March, Hamilton had to send Eliza a somber note. On Saturday, my dear Eliza, your sister took leave of her sufferings and friends, I trust, to find repose and happiness in a better country. I long to come to console and comfort you, my darling Betsy. Adieu, my sweet angel. Remember the duty of Christian resignation. Peggy's funeral at the Patroon's manor house was attended by all of his many tenants, marching in mourning. So aside from wanting to thwart Burr and Clinton, Hamilton must have felt compelled to assist young Stephen Van Rensselaer, who had been widowed at the advent of his gubernatorial race. In a blizzard of articles and speeches, Hamilton credited the Federalists with producing peace and prosperity. He also tried to convert the election into a referendum on the Republican infatuation with France, evoking the hideous despotism of Napoleon that was defended by the bayonets of more than 500,000 men in disciplined array. After Jefferson's victory, the New York Federalists were desperate to resuscitate their party. As he campaigned with verve, Hamilton felt the full fury of vengeful Republicans, who were giddy with their recent triumph. At one of the polls, General Hamilton, with impunity by the populace, was repeatedly called a thief, and at another poll, with the same impunity, he was called a rascal, villain, and everything else that is infamous in society, Robert Troup reported. What a commentary is this on Republican virtue? To restore some civility, Hamilton suggested at one Federalist rally that both candidates appoint supporters to conduct a calm, reasoned debate on the issues. Republican papers turned on him harshly and accused him of haranguing the citizens of New York in different wards in his usual style of imprecation and abuse against the character of the venerable Clinton. The same paper suggested that Hamilton should be obscure and inactive, since he had been detected in his illicit amours with his lovely Mariah, on whose supposed chastity rested the happiness of her husband and family. Burr watched amusedly as Hamilton squirmed. "Hamilton works day and night with the most intemperate and outrageous zeal," he told his son-in-law, "but I think wholly without effect." Indeed, in an especially ominous sign for Hamilton, Clinton regained the governorship by a landslide. But Clinton's return augured poorly for Burr as well. As Hamilton had predicted, President Jefferson gloried in the exercise of power and now moved to sweep Federalist office holders from New York posts. The president blatantly snubbed Burr and showered most New York appointments on the Livingstons and Clintons. In trying to prop up his base in New York, Burr saw that he would indeed have to cobble together a new coalition of disaffected Republicans and free-floating Federalists. Such a strategy also threatened any comeback meditated by Hamilton and promised sharp future clashes between the two men. Jefferson had not captured the presidency by a wide margin over Adams, but he was an agile politician with a sure sense of populist symbolism. A handsome man of sometimes unkempt appearance, Jefferson eliminated the regal trappings of the Washington and Adams administrations and brilliantly crafted an image of himself as a plain, unadorned American. The various Jeffersons served up by Hamilton in his essays, the Epicurean Jefferson, the spendthrift Jefferson, the patrician Jefferson, the indebted Jefferson, the slave-owning, love-making Jefferson, were blotted out by one of history's most impressive image-makers. For 2 weeks after his inauguration, Jefferson stayed at his boarding house near the Capitol and supped at the common table. Once in the White House, the folksy president, who had been a fashion plate in Paris, galloped through Washington on horseback, dispensed with wigs and powdered hair, shuffled around in slippers, fed his pet mockingbird, and answered the doorbell himself. When William Plumer first visited the executive mansion, he mistook the president for a servant. Only Jefferson could have turned frumpy clothing into a resonant political statement. Jefferson endowed his election with cosmic significance, later saying that the revolution of 1800 was as real a revolution in the principles of our government as that of 1776 was in its form, and the Republican press cheered his victory as a liberation from British tyranny. In fact, Jefferson proved a more moderate president than either he or Hamilton cared to admit. The Virginian no longer had the luxury of being in opposition and could not denounce every assertion of executive power as a rank betrayal of the revolution. A group of purists calling themselves old Republicans protested that the turncoat Jefferson had violated his former principles by refusing to dismantle Hamilton's system, including the National Bank. Jefferson intended to cut taxes and public debt, contract the Navy, and shrink the central government, a swollen bureaucracy of 130 employees, to a few plain duties to be performed by a few servants, but many changes were less than revolutionary. He made the mistake of scuttling much of the Navy, which was to leave the country appallingly vulnerable during the War of 1812. In the end, however, Jefferson often devised variants of Hamilton programs, stressing household manufacturers over factories, for instance. On the other hand, he overturned some bad Federalist policies and allowed the Alien and Sedition Acts to lapse. Jefferson's more extreme impulses were restrained by his Treasury Secretary, the balding, Geneva-born Albert Gallatin, who broke the shocking news to him that it was too soon to abolish all internal taxes. He educated Jefferson that the National Bank and Customs Service did help reduce the national debt. "It mortifies me to be strengthening principles which I deem radically vicious," the president replied, but he agreed that Gallatin was probably right, that we can never completely get rid of Hamilton's financial system. Indeed, Hamilton had deliberately shaped his policies so as to make it difficult to extirpate them. The new president relished the chance to rifle through Treasury files and corroborate his suspicions of Hamilton. He asked Gallatin to browse through the archives and uncover the blunders and frauds of Hamilton. Having tangled with Hamilton over the years, Gallatin undertook the task with a very good appetite, he admitted, but he failed to excavate the findings Jefferson wanted. Years later, he related the president's crestfallen reaction. "Well, Gallatin, what have you found?" Jefferson asked. I answered, "I have found the most perfect system ever formed. Any change that should be made in it would injure it. Hamilton made no blunders, committed no frauds. He did nothing wrong." I think Mr. Jefferson was disappointed. Gallatin complimented Hamilton by saying that he had done such an outstanding job as the first Treasury Secretary that he had turned the post into a sinecure for all future occupants. As for the First Bank of the United States, once denounced by Jeffersonians as a diabolical lair, Gallatin proclaimed that it had been wisely and skillfully managed. Republicans still found it hard to accept the need for the central bank. As President James Madison allowed the bank's charter to expire, and American finances suffered as a result during the War of 1812. When a chastened Madison then sponsored the Second Bank of the United States, critics inveighed that he out-Hamilton's Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton still feared that Jefferson would weaken presidential power, since he had long contended that a strong executive branch would revert to monarchical methods. A preponderance of the executive over the legislative branch cannot be maintained but by immense patronage, by multiplying offices, making them very lucrative, by armies, navies, which may enlist on the side of the patron all those whom he can interest and all their families and connections, Jefferson had written. Hamilton should have trusted his election prediction that Jefferson in office would discover the joys of presidential power. Jefferson resolved his ideological dilemma by showing outward deference to Congress while subtly steering congressional leaders at private dinners that he held three times per week at the presidential residence. One area where Hamilton perceived a legitimate threat to the Federalist legacy was the judiciary, the last redoubt of party power. Right before Adams left office, Congress had enacted the Judiciary Act, which created new courts and 23 new federal judgeships so as to spare Supreme Court justices the onerous task of riding the circuit. The High Court's justices had spent more time negotiating muddy roads than deciding cases in Philadelphia. At the end of his term, President Adams rushed through appointments for these judges, offending Republicans who thought he should have allowed the new president to choose. Worse, Adams made baldly partisan selections for a judiciary already packed with Federalists. His appointment of the so-called midnight judges rubbed old Republican wounds. The Federalists have retired into the judiciary as a stronghold, and from that battery, all the works of Republicanism are to be beaten down and erased, Jefferson declared. William Branch Giles agreed with Jefferson that the revolution is incomplete so long as the judiciary was possessed by the enemy. Thus the battle was joined between triumphant Republicans and defeated Federalists over Republican efforts to repeal the Judiciary Act. Hamilton and other high Federalists feared that Republicans would thereby destroy judicial independence. Republican ire about the Federalist dominance of the judiciary became especially strident after Adams nominated John Marshall as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in late January 1801. Marshall, 45, was a tall, genial man with penetrating eyes and a shock of unruly hair. He now rivaled, perhaps even superseded, Hamilton as the leading Federalist and had contempt for his distant cousin, Jefferson, whom he mocked as the Great Llama of the Mountain. Historian Henry Adams said of Marshall, "This excellent and amiable man clung to one rooted prejudice. He detested Thomas Jefferson." Jefferson reciprocated the animosity, especially since the new Chief Justice revered Hamilton, having once observed that beside the former Treasury Secretary, he felt like a mere candle beside the sun at noonday. After reading through George Washington's papers, Marshall pronounced Hamilton the greatest man, or one of the greatest men, that had ever appeared in the United States. Marshall considered Hamilton and Washington the two indispensable founders, and it therefore came as no surprise that Jefferson looked askance at the Chief Justice as the Federalist serpent in the Democratic Eden of our administration. During 34 years on the court, John Marshall, more than anyone else, perpetuated Hamilton's vision of both vibrant markets and affirmative government. When he became Chief Justice, the Supreme Court met in the Capitol basement in a less than magisterial setting. Hamilton had always regarded the judiciary as the final fortress of liberty and the most vulnerable branch of government. John Marshall remedied that deficiency, and many of the great Supreme Court decisions he handed down were based on concepts articulated by Hamilton. In writing the decision in Marbury v. Madison, 1803, Marshall established the principle of judicial review, the court's authority to declare acts of Congress unconstitutional, drawing liberally on Hamilton's Federalist No. 78. His decision in the landmark case of McCulloch v. Maryland, 1819, owed a great deal to the doctrine of implied powers spelled out by Hamilton in his 1791 opinion on the legality of a central bank. The scalding debate over repeal of the Judiciary Act prompted Hamilton to lambaste Jefferson in a series of 18 essays entitled The Examination. Reviving themes from the Federalist Papers, he explained why the judiciary was destined to be the weakest branch of government. It could ordain nothing. Its functions are not active, but deliberative. Its chief strength is in the veneration which it is able to inspire by the wisdom and rectitude of its judgments. For Hamilton, Jefferson's desire to overturn the Judiciary Act was an insidious first step toward destroying the Constitution. Who is so blind as not to see that the right of the legislature to abolish the judges at pleasure destroys the independence of the judicial department and swallows it up in the impetuous vortex of legislative influence? Without an independent judiciary, the Constitution was a worthless document. "Probably before these remarks shall be read," he concluded, "the Constitution will be no more. It will be numbered among the numerous victims of democratic frenzy." Despite the ink that Hamilton copiously expended and his warning before the New York bar that the law's cancellation would trigger civil war, the Republicans managed to repeal the Judiciary Act in March 1802 without incident. The repeal and other Jeffersonian innovations had spurred Hamilton and his friends to found a new Federalist paper, the New York Evening Post, now the oldest continuously active paper in America. Troup complained at the time, "We have not a paper in the city on the federal side that is worth reading." Newspaper editor Noah Webster had turned against Hamilton after the Adams pamphlet, depriving him of an outlet for his views. Marginalized but far from eliminated as a force in national affairs, Hamilton hoped the Post would chart a path for other Federalist newspapers and breathe life into a nearly moribund party. Of the $10,000 of startup capital, Hamilton likely contributed $1,000. Tradition has it that the decision to launch the Post was made in the mansion of merchant Archibald Gracie. For chief editor, Hamilton plucked one of his most colorful disciples, 35-year-old William Coleman, an engaging man with a broad, florid face and a nimble wit. Born to an impecunious Boston family, Coleman had been serving in the Massachusetts House of Representatives when Hamilton toured New England in 1796, and Coleman fell promptly under his spell. He considered Hamilton the greatest statesman beyond comparison of the age, and later dated his professional success from the time of their meeting. After moving to New York, Coleman practiced law with Aaron Burr, a decision he regretted and quickly reversed. Attracted to writers, he joined a literary society called the Friendly Club, where he mingled with Hamilton's Federalist associates. Coleman was wrestling with financial problems when Hamilton got him the coveted clerkship of the circuit court, where he employed his shorthand skills to produce the comprehensive transcript of the Manhattan Well tragedy case. William Coleman was such an unreconstructed Federalist that one Republican journalist crowned him the Field Marshal of Federal Editors. After Jefferson's election, Coleman sent the new president a bombastic epistle, accusing him of pulling down the old temple of morality and religion and erecting in its place a foul and filthy temple consecrated to atheism and lewdness. He threw himself so wholly into Stephen Van Rensselaer's gubernatorial campaign that a Republican paper predicted that this seller of tuppence halfpenny pamphlets, this sycophantic messenger of General Hamilton, will at one time or another receive a due reward. Coleman was a casualty of the back-to-back victories of Thomas Jefferson and George Clinton. After the governor's nephew, DeWitt Clinton, emerged as the reigning figure of the all-powerful Council of Appointments, he purged Federalist officeholders and ejected Coleman from his clerkship. Hamilton and his partners set up Coleman in a brick house on Pine Street. When the newspaper's first issue appeared on November 16, 1801, it sounded a patrician note, promising to diffuse among the people correct information on all interesting subjects, to inculcate just principles in religion, morals, and politics, and to cultivate a taste for sound literature. It made no bones about soliciting the backing of local merchants, announcing it would write about whatever relates to that large and respectable class of our fellow citizens. While openly admitting its Federalist pedigree, it also noted that we disapprove of that spirit of dogmatism which lays exclusive claim to infallibility, and believe that honest and virtuous men are to be found in each party. The paper soon won plaudits for its legible print, high-quality paper, and lucid, trenchant writing. None other than James T. Callender bestowed kind words upon Hamilton's publication. "This newspaper is, beyond all comparison, the most elegant piece of workmanship that we have seen either in Europe or America." The Post immediately became Hamilton's newspaper of choice for assailing Jefferson, and all 18 installments of the Examination appeared there under the name Lucius Crassus. Hamilton was no hands-off investor, and Coleman candidly described his pervasive influence on the paper. "Whenever anything occurs on which I feel the want of information, I state matters to him, sometimes in a note. He appoints a time when I may see him, usually a late hour in the evening. He always keeps himself minutely informed on all political matters. As soon as I see him, he begins in a deliberate manner to dictate and I to note down in shorthand. When he stops, my article is completed." Coleman's vignette confirms that Hamilton had a lawyer's ability to organize long speeches in his head and often dictated his essays. Otherwise, the sheer abundance of his writing is hard to comprehend. In a macabre coincidence, the New York Evening Post had its first major story on its hands just 1 week after its maiden issue, a duel involving Hamilton's eldest son. With his high forehead, luminous eyes, and Roman nose, Philip Hamilton, nearly 20, was exceedingly handsome. Smart and with a winning manner, he had followed a career path that replicated his father's.